Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonstories.org. Okay, so this has been fabulous. Let's switch really quickly to your experience with Mormon archaeologists. Yeah. And basically, I'm curious to know if you've ever pulled these guys aside and asked, man, do you believe this stuff? And how they reconcile it. I'm curious to know if you've ever seen a believing archaeologist lose it, a believing Mormonologist lose his faith, or if you've seen nuanced views of the Book of Mormon. And then finally, wasn't there a famous, you know, Mormon who wrote a book about ancient American archaeology who then stopped believing in the church and left? So
yes,
talk about all that, to the extent that you've got that stories or experience.
Yeah. Of course, this is a very tender subject.
Don't have to name names.
With archaeologists who are Mormons, a very tender subject.
Right.
I had many, many discussions over the years with Gareth Lowe, who was a really good friend. I still respect him enormously. You know, one of the great people of New World archaeology. He started out, when I first met him, that time when Doc Kidder told me to go over and look at those excavations in Chiapas. I was working on the Pacific coast of Guatemala on really early stuff, finding stuff that was quite amazing on the earliest villages. And I went over not only because of Doc Kidder telling me to be my spy in the New World Archaeology Foundation, but also because I want to see what they've been getting, because they were right next door to where I was.
Right.
And so I got to know Gareth then, and we remained close friends all through his life. Gareth was definitely a believing Mormon then. He really was, but he was bothered by certain things. There's no question about it. And he was seriously embarrassed by these amateur enthusiasts who come trundling down to his site with metal detectors in their hand, trying to shoo them out. I mean, he wanted to do serious archaeology, mm-hmm. but he was an anti-evolutionist. I don't know whether the church takes a stand on this or not now, but being the son-in-law of one of the noted evolutionists of his day, I felt I had to bring this up. And he wouldn't buy that evolution couldn't take place, but he said, it bothers me. You know, I'm bothered by this. Because he was a good thinker and whatnot. Year by year by year by year, I think he lost his faith. I think at the end, I don't think he had any of it at all left, at all. You know, he would talk ironically of some of those old Book of Mormon archaeologists like M. Wells Jakeman at BYU and people like that who really were, as I say, iron rods. But he didn't take them seriously at all, and he was a total skeptic, and on everything, and really, I'd say a scientist at the end. I think he'd lost all his faith. I don't care what anybody says. I knew him as well as anybody, and I think he'd lost his faith. I know others who had worked for the foundation who also no longer believed in it. They accepted the church as a social, cultural thing, completely, very much so.
Right.
How could they do otherwise when you're living in Utah and Provo or anywhere else? It's a complete way of life to give up. You know, when I became, a Jack Episcopalian, I didn't have to give up my way of life, you know, I mean, at all.
Right.
Not one bit.
You didn't, like, your wife didn't divorce you and your parents didn't.
That's exactly right.
Estrange you.
And
everyone judged you as being evil and wicked.
Episcopalians, Anglicans in general, are very tolerant of all this kind of stuff. They say, well, you might come back someday, but no, you may be right. Who knows? You know, they're quite open to this kind of thing, but not, of course, as we know, for Mormons. And, so it became a real problem. And, I know a really, let's just mention, I won't mention their names, a couple of really, truly outstanding Mormon archaeologists, that is, archaeologists who are Mormons. One of them doesn't like to talk about it at all. I don't think either of them want to talk about it, to me at any rate, as a goy, you know, as a Gentile, that they want to do it. They're both extremely good archaeologists and go to meetings and talk our language and never bring this stuff up, never mention Zarahemla or any of this kind of stuff, Moroni, not one word of it. But I think when they're back among the true believers, it's another story. And I just think it may be because they can't afford to openly break intellectually with their own culture and their own people and their own families and their own wives. I don't know what. I mean, it's an extremely touchy subject. You know, I've known devout Marxist archaeologists very well, who I have a lot of respect for and whatnot. But it's another thing. They can't seem to break with it. You know, it's a given mindset. I've been a rebel, I think, all my life in what I do. And I just can't I couldn't accept this kind of thing. But if you have done so, and it's a cradle-to-grave kind of thing, like Mormonism and Marxism both are, then it's a tough call. So now let's get to the one guy that you mentioned who was a believer all his life and openly broke. And this is Tom Ferguson, Thomas Stewart Ferguson, I've already talked about as this Orinda, California lawyer and ex-FBI man, who was one of the founders of the New World Archaeological Foundation. He brought out a book early on, once the foundation had been going and digging and whatnot, called One Fold, One Shepherd. And I was asked to review it. Can you imagine that? By American Antiquity, which is a kind of house journal of American archaeologists. And, you know, he's such a nice guy, I wanted to be nice to it. I didn't want to hurt his feelings at all. But I had to point out the total illogic of the whole thing. And, you know, that it's built on a foundation of sand in general and in details that just don't add up to anything. But you're dealing with a native New World culture that is mainly 99.9% autochthonous. That is, it rose up by itself. These people, these Mayas and these Aztecs and all these people did this stuff under their own steam. And this approach just is taking away from them a heritage which belongs to them and not to Europeans or to Hebrews or ancients out of the Near East or anybody. They did it themselves. And I thought that was unfair. Not unfair to Tom, but unfair to the New World peoples to take that position. And I pointed out the fallacies all through that. But, you know, the reaction is very interesting because Mormons are some of the nicest people I know.
Yeah.
And the average guy, author, who's written a book like that got torn apart in a journal the way the young Michael Coe did it, would have really been burned up and resentful and never speak to me again. Not Tom. We remained friends for a long, long time. Always cordial. I always had the best of relations with the people at BYU, the ones who I know were true believers and the ones who weren't. And I think I've kept this up. I mean, I'm still invited to BYU, wonderful Department of Anthropology, which includes archaeology now.
So why would want to talk about all this stuff and risk, you know, hurting some feelings?
Well, they're very frank about this, and their feelings if they've been hurt, they've been very nice in disguising them because they are really nice to me.
Right.
I mean, you think after my review of Tom Ferguson's book and after what I wrote in Dialogue, which is all over the internet still, you think, keep this guy out, you know? Not at all. If he'd been Marxist, I would have been sent to the gulag, but or worse, to the Lubyanka prison and shot. No, the Mormon people are really nice, moral, upstanding people, really. And as a whole, as archaeologists, they're a lot nicer than a lot of the Goyim archaeologist and anthropologist. I know a whole lot nicer. I still have very good friends among them.
Right. What happened to Ferguson?
Ferguson. I talked about the Book of Abraham, you know, and that Egyptian manuscript. He finally came to the conclusion that if Joseph Smith made up all this kind of stuff out of whole cloth, out of the top of his head, that this was the Book of Abraham, that he had the ability to translate this stuff, when, you know, actually the first steps were being taken by old world scholars like Champollion to crack the Egyptian script. You know, this is after the discovery of the Rosetta Stone. If this was made up of whole cloth by Smith out of his fertile brain, then the Book of Mormon was made up too, that there's no truth in it whatsoever. And it was just like his skin sloughed off, his heart dropped out of his body. He just lost his faith completely. But he didn't want to give up his membership of the church because it brought him so much satisfaction. He's involved, you know, his family, he's got a big family and kids and all the rest of it. And he felt guilty about doing this. But nevertheless, he couldn't intellectually, you know, his brain just couldn't handle this idea that there was any truth whatsoever in either the Book of Abraham or the Book of Mormon. So that's a tragedy. There's a lot of stuff on the internet about Tom Ferguson.
Right.
He's a tragic figure. I mean, he died, I think, a very, very unhappy man.
Hmm. All right. So do you know any credible Mormon anthropologists or anthropologists who happen to be Mormon who will look you in the eye and say, yes, I believe in a Zarahemla, and yes, I believe in the Waters of Mormon, and a King Benjamin, and in a Nephi, and in a Moroni, and I'm a credible scientist?
I think I know one.
Okay.
One. And he's very, very credible.
And then how many Mormon anthropologists do you know who don't view it that way, who don't view the Book of Mormon as a literal historical document?
Well, I can't ask them all, but
right.
I have my suspicions here. I knew one, no one. I think he's still alive.
Mm-hmm.
Who actually wrote this stuff down? Why Book of Mormon archaeology is basically a lot of hooey.
Mm-hmm.
Really, I think took a lot of brickbats for it. You know,
mm-hmm.
People like Hugh Nibley rising up to defend the faith and whatnot. It's hard to say, but I would say I know about a half dozen.
Have you known some to lose their faith completely in the Book of Mormon?
Yeah. Okay. I think Gareth Lowe is one of them.
Okay. All right.
You know, I mentioned him because I know he's dead. He, by the way, was also a wonderful guy, but also a true fundamentalist at one point. And you know what that means, but it just disintegrated on him.
Hmm.
We have many conversations about this over the years, over the decades.
Not fun. Okay, so there's this rumor that went around in Mormonism for a lot of years that, I don't know if it was Smithsonian or National Geographic archaeologists used to take the Book of Mormon along with them to help them find ancient American archaeological sites. And apparently it got so annoying to the point where the Smithsonian, I believe,
yeah,
actually published a letter. Do you know this story at all?
I do.
Talk about
a
second.
I've seen that letter and their official statement about the Book of Mormon. I don't know of any National Geographic archaeologist or anybody backed by the National Geographic anywhere in the world, whoever, especially in the New World, who would have taken the Book of Mormon with him or her.
Or Smithsonian.
As a guide. Or the Smithsonian. I've known a lot of archaeologists out of both places.
Okay.
they knew about, you know, what goes on, and they knew about Book of Mormon archaeology, but basically they didn't buy any part of it.
And okay, and are you aware of like FARMS, the Foundation for Ancient Research? And
yes, I am.
Like, you know, there's a Daniel Peterson there. There's a John Gee. There are all these different.
Well, that's Book of Mormon. Those are Book of Mormon archaeologists, essentially.
And are like, you know, when 10 non-Mormon archaeologists are sitting around smoking a cigar or drinking a glass of wine, and FARMS comes up, or, you know, yeah, Book of Mormon apologists comes up, what's the general sentiment or feeling, or would this never happen?
I think it's been mentioned, and the general feeling is that this is not a really serious scientific group at all, that it's a continuation of the old Book of Mormon archaeology that used to be practiced at BYU in the bad old days, or good old days, however you look at it, mm-hmm, by people like Christensen and Jakeman and people of that sort. It's basically true believers. I mean, you know, they've got their minds made up, and all they want to hear is confirmation of what they already know. It's a lot like Marxist archaeology. You know, the Marxists go into the field, especially this is true in the Soviet Union in the old days, used to be true in China, and it's now changed. These people are dropping a lot of their Marxism. But you only went into the field in the Soviet Union to find out whether Marx and Engels' theory about the development of societies and cultures is correct or not. And, well, you knew it was correct. You just wanted to find further corroborative evidence. And never what a scientist would ask is this true or false, period, and to pose a question. What science is a way of posing a question, or at least science has questions, poses them in a certain way where a thing can be validated or shown to be false.
Okay.
It's why science and religion don't really coordinate at all, because how can you pose a question whether God, whether there is a God or not, that can be falsified or validated, and it can never be done. And these are two different realms. So when you mix them together, as in, let's say, old-style Mormonism or Marxism, which to me is another religion, it's, or let's say Catholicism in the days when Galileo was around, it becomes not totally non-scientific. It can't be. If you accept as given everything that's in the Book of Mormon, how can you say whether it's true or false, you know, mm-hmm, as a total proposition? And it can't be done. It's a religion. It's not a scientific question. So therefore, to try to come up with the hard data without asking this question, you know, Can it be falsified as well as corroborated? You can't do it the way FARMS is approaching it.
Hmm. Can it be falsified? Like, you know, I know that some people mock this notion of, you know, there's an argument that you can never prove that God doesn't exist. You can never prove that Jesus didn't exist.
Yeah, that's not a scientific question.
And then people laugh and say, well, maybe there's a flying spaghetti monster, you know, living on the dark side of the moon, but we can't prove it. Like,
that's true.
It's so ridiculous. What would the probability be?
That's what it comes down to, is probability.
And for you, what's the probability that the Book of Mormon narrative, you know, happened and is a historical document?
It's less than 1%. I'd say it's as close to zero as you can get it. It's all probability, but it's highly improbable. Someday somebody may dig up a chariot with wheels on it, but it hasn't been done yet. Or someday somebody may dig out of a classic Maya site in a firm context a steel sword or a steel shield. It hasn't been done in 100 years, and they've been digging, I'd say, now 80 or 90 or 100 Maya sites. So I'd say the probability is almost non-existent. It exists. There's always a probability that I can jump over the Empire State Building, but it's pretty small.
And so I guess we could hear all this if I were to ask you, and the evidence from the Book of Mormon that would conflict, and the details from the Book of Mormon that would conflict with the evidence we have, percentage-wise, a lot, a little bit, none, some?
I'd say 99% almost of everything that the Book of Mormon has as details is falsifiable.
99% is falsifiable.
That's right. It's false. Yeah, you can say, do chariots exist in Mesoamerica and before, say, the Spaniards came in with wheeled vehicles? And the answer is no, they do not. You can go through that and you come up with I'd say those are falsifiable questions. Those are scientific questions.
And what about those who would try and redefine the language in the Book of Mormon? They would say, well, when they said horse, and this is a common one.
I've heard this comment.
Okay, yeah, when they said horse, they meant taper. Or when they said steel, they meant shale or some type of rock.
Yeah, right.
What are your thoughts about that?
Well, you can go through and twist all those things. I'll tell you, the person who's done most of this work is John Sorensen. Oh, he's a wonderful guy, and I respect a lot of the stuff that he's done, but I think he's barking up the wrong tree. I mean, linguistics is a science now. It's not guesswork and, you know, moving this word around and seeing if you can twist it. We know how the Maya languages work. We know their phonetics. We know their history now, going back a couple of thousand years, thanks to the great decipherment. And you can't fool around with that all that much. And you always want to remember that when the Spaniards came to the New World, they'd never dealt with these people before in their lives. They're dealing with languages that they knew nothing about. The friars learned them rather quickly, and they had to come up with words they could use in their sermons that dealt with things that were in the Bible that they were trying to put over when they were Christianizing these people. So they came up with some new vocabulary. And, for instance, this business of the Maya word is tzimin, which it means taper in Maya. And if they ever, for instance, they took that word and started to apply this to cattle, to cows, mm-hmm. which they brought in with them, which never had existed before. Then they said, okay, we have to now have a word for taper. So they use a word, a double word, tzimin kash. Kash means forest or wild jungle. So it's the cattle of the wild jungle sort of coming back. They warped the language to fit it to their own things. You have to remember where these words come from and what their history is. But in pre-Spanish times, we know what those words meant, and we know their history. Hmm. You can't warp those.
Okay. And when a Book of Mormon apologist finds, like, chiasmus in the Book of Mormon, or he finds bees in, you know, the Arabian Peninsula that sort of say, hey, wait a minute, how would Joseph have known that there were bees in the Arabian Peninsula that maybe Laman and Lemuel could have traversed through there and then came here, or even a fertile land? Or why is there chiasmus in the Book of Mormon? How could Joseph have known that chiasmus was an important thing back in the old world and now it's in the Book of Mormon? What are your thoughts about those types of proofs, you know?
Well, let's start with the bees. I used to be a beekeeper. I had six hives until the bears wiped me out 3 years in a row. So I got interested in bees. These are domesticated. These bees are old world bees. Actually, they're Italian bees, which are the best for honey production and the tamest, the least likely to sting the living daylights out of you. There are many species of bees. And, of course, a larger group of them, much, much larger group, which include New World bees. The New World bees, however, are all stingless. They keep them in log hives still today in the Maya area. You can see them back of people's houses. These are stingless bees. They don't sting. They're not old world bees at all. They're native new world bees, especially in the tropics like the Maya area. They produce a wonderful honey, but you know, they're wild as can be. They're really hard to domesticate. You really can't do it. The bees are just completely different, but there are bees, and beekeeping shows up in one of the four Maya manuscripts, actually, the gods of the beekeepers. They just simply happen to be there all along. I mean, and this particular manuscript is pre-Spanish, pre-Columbian. Had nothing to do, you know, it was already there. And it has nothing to do with bees in Arabia or Jerusalem or any other place in the Middle East. Absolutely nothing to do with it. It's a native stingless bee. They can still bite you. They can get quite unpleasant, get in your hair and in your eyebrows and so forth. They're sort of like sweat bees. You all may be familiar with that, which is a typical New World bee. Remind me what chiasmus is. I know Hugh Nibley's written about this.
I can Google it real quick and
Right.
But it's something about a pattern. It's okay. I'll read it from the great sage Google. Crossing, a rhetorical trope in which the first line or clause of a statement is repeated in reverse order in the second.
Okay, I got it. There's
why doesn't that prove the Book of Mormon's true?
It's certainly something similar to it existed in the New World, but it exists in a lot of places, actually. The most famous piece of literature from Mesoamerica, and I think the greatest piece of literature ever to come out of the New World, is called the Popol Vuh.
Yep.
It's been wonderfully translated. It's been translated into a number of languages. There's two great English translations, one by a non-LDS guy, Dennis Tedlock, who's at the University of New York, Buffalo, New York State University, Buffalo, and then by Alan Christensen, who happens to be at BYU, who's a good friend of mine, too. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful translation. In the original, and this is typical of Mesoamerican tropes altogether, to be a great...
Wait, what's a trope?
It's a form of poetry. It's a poet to say something as poetry or metaphor. It's a trope.
Okay.
And let's call it metaphorical speech. The way in the Aztecs are well documented for them, who aren't even in Book of Mormon, Zarahemla. It's a way of oratory and a poetry and a myth, declaiming myth, in which you say something as a declarative sentence in the first line. In the second line, you say something with the same meaning, but you change the words slightly. Mm-hmm. And often it's on the final word, and it often rhymes with the word in the first line. Mm-hmm. You can also do this as triplets, which is really tricky. And the Popol Vuh is written that way. The original in K'iche Maya. K'iche is one of the 29 Maya languages, mm-hmm. Still spoken in the highlands of Guatemala.
That's
you
right.
Probably heard it when you were, yep. when you were a missionary there.
Yep.
So this is what you find. But it's sort of scattered through the New World in general. It means nothing to me that this proves the Book of Mormon is correct. The Book of Mormon is, to me, frankly, a recreation of the language of the Old Testament as in the King James Bible, which I grew up on. And you find the same kind of thing there the Book of Genesis, for instance. It's very, very common in that. I mean, the stuff is basically poetry in there. But poetry is found all around the world. And
that's the kind
things
of
this nature.
All right.
Metaphorical speech where you're showing how really wonderful you are by doing this. Aztecs highly valued this. Mm-hmm. I mean, you were considered to be a great thinker and whatnot if you could speak this way. Mm-hmm. And it's all laid out how you can do it.
But doesn't prove the Book of Mormon.
It has nothing to do with the Book of Mormon.
Okay.
Except what it does show when is that Joseph Smith knew the Old Testament very, very well.
Gotcha. Okay. So so one of the biggest arguments for the Book of Mormon is its mere existence. You'll find most traditional believing Mormons will say, this is an incredible, amazing book. It's got intricate economies, entire measuring systems, currency systems. It has, you know, different styles from different authors. It it's just so inspirational, so intricate, so complex, so sophisticated, so advanced. So many things that are in there that Joseph Smith couldn't possibly have known, that there's no way that one person, especially an uneducated, illiterate farm boy from upstate New York, there's no way that he could have generated this book. So how, Dr. Coe, in the world can you explain what so many people would think is a miraculous book?
Well, this brings me to how I feel about Joseph Smith. I think, and I said it on the PBS program on the Mormons, that I think he was one of the greatest people who's ever lived. I think every once in a while you get a guy who's illiterate, or I think he wasn't totally illiterate, I think he may have been semi-literate, who had memorized, was able to memorize something like the Old Testament. I think he'd memorized a lot of it, mm-hmm. especially the book of Genesis. I think Joseph Smith was not only one of the greatest Americans who ever lived, but I think he was one of the greatest men who ever lived. He was an incredible leader. Mm. I know it's anathema to a lot of Mormons, but the biography of him, No Man Knows My History, I think it's the greatest biography ever written by Fawn Brody,
wow.
who was drummed out of the church for writing this thing. Mm-hmm. It's an incredible thing, the respect one has for Smith. After reading that, I just had enormous, one of the most interesting, amazing people. I think that the guy, if you look at his how he started and whatnot, as a very bright kid interested in old things and treasure hunting and, you know, sort of Tom Sawyer-like guy, first in Vermont, then in upstate New York, that this guy had an incredible brain. I really do think so. If you really knew the Old Testament, all those things you mentioned that, Book of Mormon apologists come up with, they're all in the Old Testament, every single one of them. And all you have to do is change things around a bit with a, you know, fairly lively imagination, and stick to the language of that which was really the beautiful English of the King James Bible, the best English ever written, I think. You can do it, and it takes an incredibly amazing guy to do this. The question is, did he fake the whole thing? Now, I think in the interview that I did for PBS, I said, as an anthropologist, I look at him as a shaman or shaman. You look at some of these amazing people who've been studied, let's say, in Africa or among the Inuit, the Eskimos, and so forth, or anywhere in North, South America. I think a lot of these people start off as kind of magicians, where it's hocus pocus. They're gonna fool somebody and do something to really put themselves on the map. But then they start picking up followers. And they wonder, now, why did this person believe this? And then you start asking yourself, well, maybe it's true what I found. And then after a while, you get enough followers, as he did. I mean, he was a born leader of men. They begin to believe that this really happened. I don't think he was a faker at the end at all, like a lot of anti-Mormon people. I think he truly believed that he had received this, you know, on the hill Cumorah, you know, as divine intervention. And I just say, if you were dealing with any old farmer, New England farmer, farm boy, and which is what he started out with, they wouldn't know anything, nothing. I mean, this guy had an inquiring mind. I think he was brilliant. I think he was a genius. And I ascribe it to that. I'm not denigrating it. I don't believe in it. I think originally he made the whole thing up, that from beginning to end. But it wasn't any old person who did it. And I think at the end, he truly believed it. He was willing to sacrifice his life for it, which is the ultimate test.
Mm-hmm. Have you thought about, you know, there's a really good book by a man named Grant Palmer called An Insider's View of Mormon Origins, where he tries to explain where he thinks the Book of Mormon came from. And there's also a book called Losing a Lost Tribe by Simon Southerton, who also tries to discuss kind of what the environment was during the day that Joseph Smith would have come up with the Book of Mormon. And, you know, we know, for example, that there were several books that talked about the Native Americans. You know, a lot of people were saying, where do these people come from? If there was a flood and the Tower of Babel, like, how did they get here to America? And so there would be theories about Israelites somehow arriving in America. Can you talk about that, or should I talk more about it? Or,
well, this goes back to the early Spanish friars. You know, they had no idea where these people came from also, and they had to deal with it very fast without, you know, no fooling. Originally they thought, well, maybe it's these were Israelites. That was one of the theories that came up. Finally, one of them, Father Acosta, said, from everything he's read about Asians and Northeast Asia and so forth, he thinks they came over, there must have been some kind of a land bridge between East Asia and there. And that, of course, that's Acosta's theory. And, of course, it finally won out and eventually became the scientific theory. Scientific fact. It's when during this time that Joseph Smith was in upstate New York. Can you still hear me?
Yep, I'm here.
Okay. When he was, you know, in upstate New York there. Upstate New York was, of course, what's called by historians the burnt over district. Mm-hmm. It was a time when all of these new religions were coming up. One of the most well-known ones were the Millerites, who prophesied the end of the world on a certain date that it never happened, and they were transformed into the Seventh-day Adventists of today. But there are a lot of others. The Shakers were very active communities at this point. I think a lot of Mormon theology, I know Mormon friends won't believe this, came from the Shakers, the idea of a male and a female god, a god goddess, a Mr. God and Mrs. God, which is very much part of Mormon theology and ingrained in Shaker theology. Hmm. The Shakers are gone because, you know, they believed in celibacy, which is not a good way to keep a religion going. There's one Shaker, working Shaker, left in southern Maine now at Seventh Day Lake, whereas, well, how many Mormons are there? 10, 15 million Mormons, which tells you something.
Right.
But I just think that this was the milieu in which this happened. It was part of the culture. We're trying to find, you know, people wouldn't accept that the Indians they knew, I mean, Joseph Smith must have known some of the Iroquoian peoples in upstate New York, the Seneca, the Oneida, the Iroquois, the rest of them. Mm-hmm. And not accepted that they could have had anything to do with the mounds that you can see, not so much in upstate New York, but in the Middle West and whatnot. At the same time this was going on, all of these people were coming up with new religions and new theories about the American Indians and having to fit them into these new religions. There were actual scientists at work, too. And our first surveys of the great mound sites of the Middle West were taking place at that time. And the conclusion that these people came to, they were, you know, U.S. government archaeologists, was absolutely correct in retrospect, that this was all the work of the ancestors of the Indians that you see there today. Mm-hmm. The Hopewell Mounds, the great Mississippian ones like Cahokia, which is one of the largest has one of the largest pyramids in the world, etc. That this was these were Indian civilizations, Native American ones, and not from white people coming over. But a lot of whites couldn't accept that. They just could not accept the idea that Indians somehow or another were inferior and because of their dark skins and their so-called primitive ways. And, of course, they were the enemy to a lot of people on the frontier. So you had to denigrate them. I mean, it's the way a lot of Americans feel about Muslims. You can't say anything nice about Muslims, you know, because you're fighting them. And it's unfair to a lot of the Muslims who don't want to be involved in this thing. The same way today with then with the American Indians. They were the enemy to probably most white Americans and were treated as such.
Okay. And so you could look at the Book of Mormon as a text and look at the environment that Joseph Smith was swimming in. And, you know, and this is kind of Grant Palmer's thesis, you know, a fifth of the Book of Mormon is copied straight out of the Bible. In fact, it's copied out of a version of the Bible that we know Joseph Smith had, where it even carries over some of the errors that that actual edition of the Bible carried. So that's like you can explain a fifth of the Book of Mormon away, like all the Isaiah part in 2 Nephi, as just direct copying from the Bible. Right. And then you've got all these evangelical ministers preaching sermons about baptism and repentance and faith and all that stuff. And, you know, Grant Palmer would say that maybe a fifth of the Book of Mormon is just sermons that Joseph Smith heard in the Burnt Over District that he puts into the mouths of King Benjamin and Alma and Mosiah and all these great people.
And the Second Coming, of course.
Right. And all that kind of stuff. And then there's a good chunk, some would argue there's a good chunk of Joseph Smith's own narrative in there, that he had brothers, that he had a father who was a visionary. In fact, there's even a record of the of Joseph Smith Sr. having a dream very much like Lehi's dream was, with the tree and the fruit and too delicious to the taste, and a lot of the stuff about a younger brother who was righteous and maybe a little more noble than some of his older brothers. And you could write off a good chunk of the Book of Mormon to that. And then if you want to say that there was these concerns about the Native Americans, these racist teachings about a light and a dark-skinned people, and even, you know, from the Book of the View of the Hebrews and other books, even, you know, claims or allegations contemporary to Joseph Smith that that maybe the origin of the Native Americans, you know, came from Israel and Jerusalem itself, you can find books that said that, then that whole part about the race narrative and the dark and the light skin and the traveling from Jerusalem can all be attributed to those sources. Yeah. Is that right?
That sounds right. That sounds convincing to me, actually. You know, you mentioned the dream of Lehi. There are two very interesting publications that came out back in the days when the Book of Mormon archaeologists were running the archaeology department in BYU, about what we know of as Stela 5 from Esapa. That's a wonderful site that the New World Archaeological Foundation excavated, wrote wonderful reports on, and a very early one that's in Chiapas, not too far from where I was digging in Guatemala, full of beautiful carved stone monuments, really interesting ones. The stelae are, let's say, slabs, stones with reliefs on them, full of iconography, gods doing all sorts of interesting stuff, stuff right out of the Popol Vuh narrative, actually, having to do with the hero twins and their defeat of the underworld gods, etc. There's one publication with that stela on it, which is a very big and intricate one. It's been, you know, artists have been trying to copy it many times because it's somewhat worn. One is a straightforward description of this stela. It dates, I would date the thing to about 100 BC, maybe, late, what we call late pre-classic or late formative. And it's very Maya in its content, actually. Mm-hmm. The this scene that it describes shows a world tree, not a cross, but a world tree with a lot of branches, mm-hmm. all kinds of other weird-looking stuff going on underneath it, all of which I think can be explained from Mesoamerican precedent. Mm-hmm. That comes out with a plain cover with it looks like an archaeological report, and it's very good by M. Wells Jakeman, who was a Book of Mormon archaeologist, very important one back in those days. Then there's one that's put out for the true believers, which is totally different in content and in its cover. Its cover is, I've got it, it's wonderful. It's blue, and the so-called Tree of Life, Lehi's Dream, is all in gold. Mm-hmm. It's a gold on blue one. It's a magnificent looking publication. It's a pamphlet, but it really looks good. And inside it is it's completely Dream of Lehi interpretation. So that is for the true believers. And the other one for the Gentiles like myself and whatnot. This split goes all the way back. You know, people trying to narrow this thing down so that became an icon. And they made plaster or plastic replicas of it, very good ones, and sent all around the world to. So it becomes a sort of like the Russians would have an icon in the corner with a candle burning from it. I've seen it in Mormon houses that I've been in. There's the Dream of Lehi. It's Stele of Five from Esapa. It's just a different world. And if you want to believe, that's it. But if you take a scientific point of view, you'll have to read the other publication. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's two different worlds.
So, okay. So I guess those who've made it through this podcast so far would kind of view this as a stinging denunciation or critique or, you know, evisceration of the Book of Mormon.
You mean from my point of view?
And just the narrative of this podcast, right? I mean,
I would never eviscerate somebody's holy book. I mean, the Quran, you can look on the Quran, you know, you can do that kind of job on the Quran. But I don't think it's a good idea, really. Because
how's that not what we're doing?
An enormous amount of people believe in this thing, and I'm not going to take their beliefs away from them. Just don't make me believe it.
Well, how is that not what we're... I mean, okay, I'm not saying should you have done this podcast, but I mean... I think the effect to those who listen, who are trying to square these things, the data and the perspective that you offer will, you know, will have that effect for some, right?
Well, you know what Jesus said famously when asked, Rabbi, should we pay taxes to Caesar? And he said, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and render unto God what is God's. And to me, this means that there's two paths here. One is science and the other is religion. And they don't mix up very well in most cases, and particularly not in the case of the Book of Mormon. If people feel that this makes their lives better, as it obviously does for several million people, I'm not going to take that away from them. But don't tell me that this is science, because it's not.
Hmm. And what, you know, let's say there's someone who says, well, Dr. Coe, I believed, you know, the Book of Mormon isn't just some peripheral part of Mormon doctrine and theology. The church calls the Book of Mormon the keystone of its religion. Joseph Smith claimed that the Book of Mormon is the most correct book on the face of the earth. If the Book of Mormon is a laughingstock to non-LDS anthropologists, and if the historical record and the scientific record, if 99%, you know, percent of it is contradicted by the scientific record versus what's in the Book of Mormon, you know, this is devastating to me and to my faith and to my religion. And, you know, do you have thoughts or feelings or perspective on that clash? I mean, you can kind of live in a partitioned world where you kind of reap the benefits of science and of intellectual inquiry, and at the same time compartmentalize and still believe. But at some point, for some, it becomes untenable. But then you don't want to throw off the traditions and the heritage of your forefathers. So now I'm asking you to step out of the realm of scientist, and now into the step and into the place of a counselor, or a father, or a sage. But how would you help someone who's sort of reaching this point in their lives, facing this conflict? What would you say to
I started out with a little bit of biography. I mean, I'm not a believing Christian. That's certainly true. But I'm not going to give up my culture. I'm not going to give up what's in the Bible necessarily. Not going to give up the teachings of Jesus, because they were very good teachings. I just happened to not believe in the supernatural side of it, in the miracles, in the transubstantiation of the host, all these things that go along with Christianity. I simply can't accept them as a scientist, totally. But I think in the world of morals and ethics and things of that sort, texts like the Bible, particularly the Sermon on the Mount, which unfortunately doesn't seem to be followed by many political fundamentalist Christians these days, I think those are really important to go by. I mean, the Golden Rule. These are things given in these texts which have nothing to do with science. They have to do with living as a human being. You know, I mean, I'm a father, I'm a grandfather, many times over. And in fact, people think I'm a Mormon because I have so many children and grandchildren. I want them brought up in the right way. But you don't necessarily have to accept supernatural explanations to do that. There's a lot of morality in these things. The Bible's full of things of this sort. I mean, the book of Job about, how do you cope with disaster and misfortune? But certainly the teachings of Christ can stand by themselves. Jefferson, one of our great founding fathers and presidents, actually constructed for himself out of the Gospels all of the things that Jesus actually said during his time on earth. And as a core of, he wasn't a big believer either. I don't think he believed at all in the supernatural, but he tried to follow.
Who didn't?
Jefferson.
Oh, okay. Yeah, right.
And I think other people in his generation were that way. A lot of the founding fathers, basically, at the most, they were deists who kind of believed in a general kind of nature worship. But you could be a very moral, ethical, decent person without having to go the God way and decide that there's some, pie in the sky and a supernatural up there. Most scientists that I know, and I think there have been polls taken of this, are either agnostics or atheists. And they live very moral, good lives. They're good people. Darwin was one of the finest people who ever lived, in spite of what these enemies against evolution say. He was a better Christian than almost all Christians I know, to his family, to his people, to his country, to his contemporaries and whatnot. I mean, he was an exemplar. And yet he didn't have any faith. He lost it. But he was a very moral, ethical person. If you can take this out of the Book of Mormon, don't give it up.
Okay. So you're saying that you can embrace science and the historical record, and either look at religion as more of a social phenomenon, as a moral phenomenon, a spiritual phenomenon in your life, and just let go of the literality of it all, and kind of become,
absolutely,
as you wrote in Dialogue, kind of a Liahona Mormon, or a metaphorical, symbolic Mormon, a cultural Mormon, but yeah, not take the doctrines and the teachings literally. That's one option.
That's
right?
Exactly the point. And you come right to it.
Or you can stop believing, but still be a highly moral, ethical person.
That's absolutely true.
In its own right.
The majority of scientists in the world are that way, believe it or not. They're not
demons,
crazed madmen doing what they want to do with the world. They're family men too.
You're not debaucherous? Are you saying you're not debaucherous?
No. you can give up all supernatural stuff and live a decent life as part of your own culture and society.
Have you
known? It's hard for Mormons, though, because that's a cradle-to-grave thing. I mean, you're in a place where the majority of the people around you are Mormons, and you're part of a society. You've been educational system. Everything you do is surrounded with the church. And I think this was a dilemma faced by Tom Ferguson. But I think the thing to do is to be philosophical about it and accept that this is a good way of life. But you don't have to accept the literal side of the Book of Mormon at all to do that.
Now, some people are going to say, man, it's either true or false. And if it's false, I'm out of here. You know what I mean?
Well, you know, there's a lot of history behind this. After all, you have to remember that LDS was once at war with the United States. You know, there's a lot of bad history here.
Right.
And, you know, the one of the first Sherlock Holmes books, A Study in Scarlet, is all about the avenging angels and the Danites chastising and tearing after Mormon apostates. It's an amazing book. I mean, incredible story. But there's a long history about this, and anti-Mormonism, anti-Mormon feelings, and vice versa. There's a terrible history of this. So I think a lot of people will say, man, I'm out of here, too. But for a lot of people, it's impossible. That's their lives. Mm-hmm. They're living there. I mean, there they are.
What if people were to just discount you and your perspective? This Dr. Coe is just clearly an anti-Mormon with an axe to grind. He's just an atheistic, secular, bitter, angry man who must have been wronged by someone at some point and is just coming at us as much as he can. What would you say to that?
Well, okay, it's not true.
Where's your evidence? Where's the data?
I'm not going to, you know, throw my curriculum vitae at you, but I have managed to raise a family, children, and wonderful grandchildren, to be surrounded with a circle of friends, both scholars and non-scholars and all kinds of people, many of whom are fellow fly fishermen. And I have had some of the best students in the world while I've been at Yale, who are still part of my family in many respects. Mm-hmm. And they now have their students who I look on as my grandchildren. Mm-hmm. And they are starting to get senior and to have their students too. So I don't think I've done wrong.
Right. Gotcha. And just really quickly, in this world of new media, Facebook and Twitter and such, you know, different things are kind of possible. I went ahead on Facebook and just kind of posted, hey, I'm finishing up an interview with the Yale anthropologist Dr. Coe, and you know, a bunch of people are having this big long conversation before this interview is even released. And a close family member of mine, this is what he wrote. He wrote, if Dr. Coe thinks there is no evidence for the crucifixion of Jesus, then I'm not sure why I should care what he says about the Book of Mormon. And so he's basically, and really what my question there is, what about people who say, oh, well, the Book of Mormon, okay, problem with that, but we still got the Bible to cling to. Yeah. Like, you know, is the Bible, if someone's going to dig into the Bible, are they going to find similar archaeological problems or not quite as severe? Or,
well, let's say which part of the Bible you're dealing with. Right. There's plenty of archaeological evidence for quite a lot of the stuff in the Bible.
Okay.
But there's no, for instance, take the Exodus, which is so important,
Judaism,
you know, to believing Jews as well as Christians. There's no archaeological evidence whatsoever that the Exodus ever took place. There is not one shred of evidence for this.
Mm-hmm.
So there's whole sections of the Bible that are there for a purpose, but it's not. It's to convince people that there was a reality when there was no reality there. And the Exodus is a fiction. It's what you would expect from a people who are lording it over other people of a different ethnic group or a different tribe, that we came in and we conquered you people. You know, we took this land over. You know, that's what it's all about. And you find this type of myth for the Aztecs, have a very similar myth like that, that they came in and conquered all these people and made things new. You know, came out of the desert and did these wonderful things. It's a typical thing that you find in anthropology and archaeology around the world. So there's a lot of the Bible that one cannot take. To get back to the crucifixion, there isn't any archaeological evidence or even valid historical evidence from the Romans, let's say, that there was ever, that Christ was ever crucified. We know they crucified plenty of people, thousands, sometimes tens of thousands of people. Is that the way? Did that actually happen? Probably did. I mean, I'm not denying that, but there isn't any, you know, scientific evidence for it. I think the Romans later on pretty much decided that Jesus lived, that there was such a person, because they had to deal with his followers. But as far as the miracles go, and you know, the ascension to heaven, there isn't any evidence for that. That's in the realm of religion, of God, and keep it there. There's no archaeological scientific evidence for this at all. That's all I'm trying to say.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, this is a tough thing for believing Mormons to hear, but I think it's important if we're going to live in a world of reality, if we're going to benefit from all that science has provided us. I don't think we as Mormons can just conveniently dismiss what science and history and linguistics and anthropology and archaeology and, you know, genetics all tell us about the Book of Mormon. So I really appreciate you being willing to share with us your life's work and perspective, even though it's a really tough pill to swallow.
It is. I mean, I don't have any feelings of vengeance or anything of that sort. Not at all. I'm dispassionate about it. As I say, I have a lot of very good friends who happen to be Mormons, so I'm certainly not out to get them by any means. I respect them, absolutely. And I respect what, you know, what's been done by the church in many places. But as far as scientific truth of it, no. I can't swallow it.
Gotcha. Well, let's end in the way Mormon Stories always ends. Well, first of all, thanking you so much. You're brilliant. And it seems like you've led a really good, meaningful, exemplary life in so many ways. And I'm inspired. Makes me wish I could start my life over a little bit in some ways. But you know, you may not, you know, I usually ask the people that I listen to kind of bear their testimony about the truths of Mormonism that they still embrace. And I'm not going to ask you to do that, but what I would ask you to do is to bear your testimony just about the things that are true for you in your life. And when a Mormon says bear their testimony, it just means give us, you know, a few minutes of what's true and what's meaningful and what's lovely that you've learned from your experiences in life. It's a tall order, but just tell us a little bit about your life's philosophy and what you find is beautiful and true as a way to maybe close this interview, if you don't mind.
Well, I think the first thing is, of course, I'm involved with my own family, in my own society, in my own country, in my own world. And I think science can help understand all of this. I really can. I think there's a scientific way to knowing all these things that is not necessarily the way of religion, although religion, you know, looks for things that perhaps science doesn't. But it's been a meaningful life for me. I've had, to me, to contemplate, to read about what's going on in astronomy, cosmology, about the beginnings of the world, about how the Earth and the Moon were formed and the galaxies and all the rest of it. To me, this is gives me a feeling of immense awe at everything. Not that I believe that there's a supernatural hand running everything. I get an immense kick out of reading about the evolution of people and of man. And I also, at the other side, that I think I have been influenced by Christ's teachings. I mean, not that I'm a Christ-like person in any way, but that his way of living and dealing with other people was the right one, absolutely. I mean, and tolerance is certainly one thing that I think I've learned from that. which is not found in a lot of religions by a long shot. Tremendous amounts of intolerance and hatred are bred by religions. You only have to look at the world today, what's going on. People like Yugoslavia, ex-Yugoslavia, for instance, all the identical people, three different groups, Serbs, Bosnian Muslims, and Catholic Croats. They're all identical, speak the same language, absolutely in culture, the same people. And yet they hate each other. They're willing to kill each other. And why? Because they all differ in religion. Religion can lead to terrible intolerance as well as tolerance. The history of religion, of Christianity, has been a very bad one, actually, in Europe and elsewhere. But if you took what was the germ of the thing, what Christ actually said and stood for, that's a different story. And you can do that without being a believer that there is a God, and do it very well, as many people have, as Darwin had, who I think, if I were asked who was the greatest man who ever lived other than Jesus, I would say Darwin. And I've had other scientists, very distinguished ones in this case, tell me the same thing. He was a wonderful person, and I think I'm to be loyal to one's family and good to them, and then to be loyal to one's society and country. Those are all important things, and I don't think you need give them up just because you don't have a sacred text to hark back to all the time. I think that's all part of my life. Well, that's my philosophy, and, for what it is, and that's the way I am, and I'm too old to change it.
Well, Dr. Michael Coe, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. Is there any book or website or anything I can help you promote to thank you for what you've shared with us today? Anything you want to leave us with? Something to go
well,
to?
Well, if you want, I actually wrote an autobiography, a memoir.
Oh.
And it's, yeah, and it's called Final Report. Now, that sounds grim. Okay, that's the last thing this guy's going to say, and then he's off. It's called Final Report, published by Thames and Hudson, New York. And it's called Final Report because archaeologists, after they finish, you know, tearing a site apart and doing all this digging and whatnot, have to write a final report. And this is a final report on what I know as an archaeologist and as a human being.
Oh, wow. Okay, we'll try to remember to put a link up to that when we put
a self-advertising.
All right, Dr. Coe, thank you so much. I can't thank you enough.
Thank you, John, for inviting me.
All right, take care.
All right, bye.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. Music today was provided by the Saber Rattlers. Check them out at saber-rattlers.com. The Mormon Stories logo was generously donated by StudioCase.com. Thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. Better far for us to strive our useless cares from us to drive, to this end joy your hearts will swell. Oh, all is well, all is well. journeys through.